You guys are all aware by now, quite aware, that my basic thesis in terms of the middle of Sefer Bereishis until the end is that it's really a book about deception. And we started with Yaakov deceiving his father for the brachos, and then Yaakov engaging in this incredibly complex pattern of deception, where Yaakov runs away instead of dealing with his problems. And then in Parshas Vayetze, Yaakov has to run away again. He's running away. In this case, he's running away from the house of Laban. And the Torah testifies that he was being deceptive. Vayignov Yaakov, eslev Laban ha'arami. And meanwhile, it's going in both directions. Right? So Laban is trying very hard to deceive Yaakov. Right? Remember, what the Torah says is that perhaps the most egregious deception of them all was that Yaakov is actually in a position where he marries a woman that he never intended to marry in terms of Leah. So the deception is piling up. And then we pointed out last week that Rachel gets involved in the deception, that she deceives her father, and she steals things that are very valuable to her father. It's a little bit of a dispute, were they actually idols themselves? That seems to be the position of Rashi. The Ramban takes the position that they were sort of like elements of superstition. And we have this very, very complicated act of deception. What we tried to explain last week was that Yaakov can only transform from being Yaakov, which literally means crooked, or as Rashi says, it implies the language of sneakiness or even trying to ambush somebody, to Yisrael, which is a royal name, Sar V'Nagid, that he can only make that transition once he's actually made an honest confrontation and he stood and fought as opposed to running away. And that's the way that we interpreted the incident in the middle of that night where Yaakov has the struggle with the man angel and he undergoes a very severe test. And he's wounded, and we tried to point out somewhat poetically, right, the idea is he can't run away anymore, because his leg is wounded, so he can't run away, but he doesn't need to, right? And that's the transformation and between Yaakov and Yisrael. And what we had started to discuss last week is the idea that even though the angel is the one to suggest this name change, God only validates it after two things happen. And this is the point that Terry and I were going back and forth on at the very end last week. I suggested the two things that needed to happen for Yaakov to really earn the name change to Yisrael, that is to say, from the crooked one to the one who's straight, was number one, he had to rebuke his sons for engaging in deception. Remember, now his sons get in on it, and they deceive the people of Shechem. The Torah says that they answer the people of Shechem, bimirma. Bimirma literally means with deception, and it's the same word that Yitzchak ascribed to Yaakov. Remember, Yitzchak says to Esav, oh my God, there's been a disaster here. Ba achicha bimirma. Your brother came in utter and total deception. And now Yaakov's own sons behave that way. And so Yaakov has to renounce that. Yaakov has to tell his sons that this is totally unacceptable. And he's very consistent about that. That was point number one. Point number two, that this is what Terry and I were discussing last week, is that we found that Yaakov's mother, according to the Midrash, had to die for his name to actually be changed. Rivka's death is not recorded literally in the Torah, but midrashically speaking, when we learn about the death of Devorah, who was Meinekes Rivka, she was her nursemaid, Rashi comments that Yaakov was being informed that his mother died. And Yaakov, once he was distanced a little bit from his mother was the one who initiated this entire pattern of deception. So once he's distanced from his mother in that way, God can actually change his name to Yisrael, meaning the honest one. That was essentially where we had left things off. So just to continue with this thesis, my reading of Sefer Bereishit is that the deception, once it's been unleashed in Parshas Toldos, cannot be contained. That's really the entire message of this 6 weeks of Shiurim that we've been having. So let me just try to chart it out in Parshas Vayeshev. Parshas Vayeshev is all about deception. Of course, the first and most painful deception is the deception of Yaakov. Yaakov, who began this pattern by deceiving his own father, in the context of a bracha, is deceived by his own children in a very, very brutal and cruel fashion, right? They know that their father, the Torah testifies, they know that their father has a very deep attachment to Yosef. Now, a lot of that has to do with the fact that he lost Rachel, and so all of those feelings of Rachel are transferred onto Yosef. The Torah says that Yosef actually looked very much like Rachel. As you can imagine, the attachment was a very deep one, and the brothers resented this. That's an understatement. And they participated, and we're not going to have a whole shiur on it now, they participated in his sale. My personal opinion is that they didn't actually sell him. They put him in a pit, on the advice of Reuven. Reuven says, put them in a pit. If you read the Torah carefully, what you actually find is that other people sold Yosef. The Torah says, Vayavru anashim midyanim socharim. There were midyanim who happened to come by. Vayim shechu vayalu as Yosef minabor. Vayim kru as Yosef la yishmaelim basim chasef. And they sold Joseph to the Ishmaelim, who were international traders, and they brought him down to the land of Egypt. Of course, the law of unintended consequences. Once you throw somebody in a pit, right, things can get out of control. That's important detail in the story. But be that as it may, the cover-up is always worse than the sin itself. So now they've got to cover it up. They realize immediately, they start thinking, what are we going to tell our father? So their choice is not to tell him what happened. They really had two choices. They could either tell the truth or they could lie. So they chose to lie. They chose to deceive him. Now, whether or not they really deceived him, whether or not he actually believed their story was not a very good story, right? Because their story was, we found this article of clothing. Now, again, there's like, 100 square mile area between Yaakov in Hebron and where this incident allegedly happened in Shechem. So for them to somehow find his cloak, which happened to be bloodied, and say, oh, we found this, do you recognize it as your son's cloak or not? That's incredibly unlikely. So their story isn't a very good one, right? I think we could all recognize as parents, if you knew about tension between your kids and one of them is presenting you this story, which on its face makes no sense. So whether or not Yaakov believed them is a different story, but certainly they chose to perpetrate this lie. Now, the cruelty was not so much in the lie itself, just take 30 seconds to process this, that they maintained this lie for over two decades. Okay, for 22 years, nobody had rachmanas, nobody had any compassion on Yaakov to actually own up to what they could have told them at least a little bit about what had actually happened, and nobody did this. Now, they had probably various motivations for doing this, but this is a very deep lie. This is a 22-year-old lie. Now, I think it is relevant to point out, and it's at least a mitigating factor. I'm not exonerating them in the least. Part of the reason they don't tell Yaakov is they don't exactly know what happened themselves. Right? They don't really know what happened themselves. They know that he was in the pit. They know that he was gone. Torah says Reuven went back to the pit. Reuven's idea was he was going to bring Yosef back to safety. Vine en Yosef babor. And Reuven starts screaming, Yosef is gone. What is going to happen? So undoubtedly for the next 22 years, they debated amongst themselves, what should we tell our father? But it wasn't clear what they should tell their father because they themselves weren't sure. But they at least could have and didn't own up to the original deception, which is that the ketonus, they didn't find the ketonus. Okay, the ketonus wasn't bloody. They slaughtered a goat and dipped it in blood. Okay, so that's the first major deception of the parsha. And this is a very, very important point. And like I say, the deception continues. But the idea of Yosef being the victim of deception continues to be the central theme of the parsha. Of course, how does Yosef end up in jail? Well, Ashes Potiphar engages in this terrible act of deception. Really, we know what she's interested in. I mean, Yosef refuses. And again, she perpetrates this deception against Yosef, and he ends up in prison. Now, again, as I said a moment ago in the context of Yaakov, Yaakov almost certainly didn't fully believe the story his children were telling him, and I'm quite certain that Potiphar did not believe the story that his wife was telling him. If Potiphar actually believed any element of that story, there's no doubt that Yosef would not have ended up in jail. Yosef would have ended up, drawn and quartered, that would have been getting off easy. He would have been tortured and killed immediately if Potiphar actually believed his wife's story. But be that as it may, it's this deception. And you say, okay, big deal. We know the end of the story. He gets out of jail and he becomes the viceroy of Egypt. But let's not forget, there's a debate in the rabbinic sources. It's not entirely clear. He spent somewhere between 2 and 12 years in jail. And none of us would want to spend 2 to 12 minutes in jail, let alone 2 to 12 years. So the pattern of deception that was triggered with Yaakov deceiving his father and continued on in terms of the way that Laban treated Yaakov, then Yaakov treated Laban, the way that Rachel treated Laban, and then when they finally come home and then the brothers are treating Yaakov, Yaakov's own sons are deceiving him, and Yaakov's own sons are deceiving the people in Shechem. Well, this pattern will continue. And the basic theme, the basic point that we keep on trying to return to is the idea that deception begets further and further deception. Once the path of deception has been opened, it becomes almost impossible to extract or to extricate yourself from this path of deception. Now, of course, what I'm setting up is what we're going to discuss, you know, further and further next week, is that who continues with this pattern of deception? Yosef. And instead of owning up to who he is, his brothers come, and all of a sudden, Yosef has this very complex act of deception. He's pretending to be somebody that he won't be. Okay, and this will, of course, set up the great confrontation, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, where Yosef will finally admit who he is, Ha'od Avichai, and then the entire story starts to come together, and all of the answers finally begin to reveal themselves. But to appreciate Sefer Bereishis and to appreciate the connections between one parsha and the next, what you have to appreciate is that it's all one deception leading to a second deception leading to a third deception. Let me just, in the last 3 minutes that I have, touch on one other aspect of the parsha, which is, of course, a story all about deception. It's a double deception. Okay, the Torah says that Yehuda suffered terrible depression. Yehuda realized that he was in a position of natural leadership. He had a great charisma about him, and his brothers would have really listened to him had he stood up for Yosef. And the Torah says, "Vayi ba'esahi vayered Yehuda me'esachav," which basically means Yehuda left the family. He went into a depressive mode. And Yehuda begins his own life. He really can't bear to see his father. He knows what he's done to his father. And Yehuda marries, and he has his own family, and his two sons, Aaron, Onan, and then a third son, Shelah. And I think the story is familiar to most people. He marries off his oldest son, Er, to a woman named Tamar. And his sons are, they're not really good people. And it's sad because Yehuda wants to be a good person. And they treat Tamar very poorly, very humiliating and demeaning. Well, the way they don't, she wants very much to become a mother. They don't want her to become a mother. So the way that they treat her in a sexual context is very demeaning. Er doesn't want her to become pregnant because then she wouldn't be beautiful anymore. Onan doesn't want her to become pregnant because then it's not really his child. It'll be a legacy to his brother, which is, you know, not an admirable trait. So in any event, Yehuda then is stuck with Tamar. Er and Onan die. And the idea would be that he was supposed to marry her off to the third son, to Shelah. Now, of course, what can Yehuda do? He can either tell the truth, which is to say, this is not working out. The older two sons died. Let's go in different directions. Or he could lie. So what does Yehuda do? He lies. So he says, you know, the truth is, Shelah's a little on the younger side. So if you just wait around, you know, then we can organize the wedding. So there's a little bit of machlokas between Rashi and Ramban on this point about whether or not he would. But the simple pshat is what Rashi says, that he was lying, and he was engaged in this pattern of deception all over again. So Tamar is a very bright woman, and she realizes that she's being given a story, and ultimately she has no future here. So what does Tamar do to Yehuda? So she deceives him, right? And Yehuda, in this very important moment when he's about to execute her for, you know, supposedly her crimes, which are really in effect his crimes, he's the one that triggered all of this. Yehuda, in this first moment of honesty in Sefer Bereishis, foreshadowing what will happen later on in Sefer Bereishis, where Yehuda will force Yosef to admit the truth, to admit who he really is. We haven't gotten there yet. Yehuda says publicly, "Tzad kam imeni, I was the deceiver. I was the one who precipitated all of this." And this is the story of Parshas Vayeshev. Three great deceptions. Deception of Yaakov by the brothers, by the sons, number one. Yehuda's deception of Tamar, Tamar's counter-deception of Yehuda. And finally, the deception of Eshes Potiphar. But you can't study Vayeshev as an island. It's not a self-contained unit. It's part of this very long story of deception. It was all triggered by Yaakov and Esav. Rivka got the ball rolling in terms of deception, and from that point on, it has spun totally out of control until, of course, the entire Jewish people will have to leave Canaan. They're going to go down to Mitzrayim. They're going to go down to Egypt. And then, of course, that's effectively where the Jewish people will be formed. But again, one cannot emphasize enough that in a word, Sefer Bereishis is a story about deception. And a story about the dangers of deception. Again, just to conclude where I started, when one chooses to go down that path, there's really no hope of extracting yourself until something very dramatic occurs. And once we get up to Parshas Vayigash, we'll appreciate that confrontation. Yosef lo yachol Yosef liyisapek lechol hanitzavim alav, where Yosef cannot hold back the truth any longer. That will lead to the entire family coming back together, and then the story is brought towards its resolution. Okay, hold it up there. Thank you.